Today's Teisho, today's talk, will be on case 16 in the Mumon Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 16 is entitled When the Bell Sounds. Mumon said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Mumon's comment: in studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is simply the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that the real Zen student commands sound, controls form, is clear-headed at every event, and free on every occasion? Granted, you are free, just tell me. Does the sound come to the ear, or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. Mumon's verse: with realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. So some of you are here for the first time, and I'm very glad you came this morning on this beautiful spring day to practice Zen. You might not be familiar with the Zen style of teaching, but part of Zen practice is a meditation on what are called koans, koan meditation. And a koan you could think of as a story that records a moment of realization. So one way to teach Buddhism or to teach Zen would be to give you some abstract ideas and say, an abstract idea would be form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Another one is all is one. That would be an abstract idea. There are many such ideas, but you know, hearing them and even believing them doesn't really change how you experience the moment. So Zen practice is based on a little different principle. Conveying information to people doesn't necessarily change their deep mental habits. What has to happen is a process that goes on in the mind. Gradually, it's like learning to see in a new way. And to assist in that process, Zen has developed, you could say, teaching tools called koans. And a koan is basically a story about a moment of insight or awakening. So instead of studying abstract principles of Zen or abstract principles of Buddhism, we have these stories, which are moments when somebody manages to move beyond conventional experience or conventional thinking and have a fresh insight. Sometimes the stories are quite involved, and sometimes they're rather brief. You know, the story might be as simple as a teacher entering the room and holding up his fly whisk, and just holding it up, or holding up his staff and saying, "This is a staff." So it can be very simple stories, sometimes very complex, Ideally, what you would do is not think about the story, but process the story. And in Zen, what that means is that you learn how to enter deep samadhi by focusing on your breath. And when you can enter into non-dualistic awareness, an awareness that is no longer separate from the world, samadhi, you can begin to internalize the koan. And koans, when they're used this way, are like medicine. You know, something is bothering you very much, say you didn't get a promotion, you go and tell your friend, "I didn't get the promotion," the friend can say, "Your boss is no good." The friend can say, "You deserved it. It's not fair." The friend can say many other things, but they're unlikely to remove your sense of injury and distress. Because words don't penetrate very deeply by themselves. But it's possible that even though you're upset at not getting a promotion and a raise, maybe you decide to drive up into the state park, the Worthington State Forest in northern New Jersey, and you spend the afternoon hiking up to Sunfish Pond. And as you hike up to Sunfish Pond, you smell the beautiful clean air, you see the water flowing down the stones, you see the beautiful trees along the riverbank, plants, the flowering plants, azaleas, rhododendrons. And you hike, it's hard to hike, you know, it's like a 5.5 mile a trip. It's uphill the first half, and you're sweating, you're perspiring, your legs hurt. You're thinking maybe you won't go the full way, and finally you get to Sunfish Pond. It's this beautiful clearing. And then you hike back, and it's the end of the day. The sunset is a beautiful shade of rose and blue. And you get back into your car, and you're not so bothered by what has happened to you. See, that's a deeper transformation. And it takes place on a deeper level than words and ideas. So koans work like that. They speak to a part of the mind that's deeper than thinking. Deeper than thinking. Deeper than a thought. Consciousness. See, if you hike, if you're in distress because you didn't get a promotion, and you go hiking up to Sunfish Pond, you're not necessarily thinking, "Ah, the sound of the water is very beautiful. The sunlight on the rhododendron leaves is glistening." You know, you're not necessarily hearing the birds consciously. You're not necessarily thinking, "Ah, nature, I feel at ease here." See, you don't have to think those things because your awareness is taking all of this in and processing it at a much deeper level. And if somebody said, So here you're upset that you didn't get a raise, and you say, "Well, I'm not upset anymore. I went hiking up to Sunfish Pond." Somebody might say, "Well, what does that have to do with anything?" Right? What does that have to do? You still didn't get the raise, you know. But now you don't feel badly about it. And what has happened is a deeper unconscious transformation, see? Somehow your trust in life has been restored. Your sense of well-being and wholeness has been restored, even though you've suffered this injury. See? So things people say to you wouldn't have solved the problem. You had to go through a deeper process. And koan training is like that. Once you can enter samadhi, you hold the koan in your mind. Usually in the story, there's what we call a turning phrase. There's just a few words that are the heart of the koan, And when you can enter into samadhi, you internalize those words, that turning phrase, and you repeat it on your out-breath like a mantra. It's like a little bit like a mantra. And it begins to have a psychoactive quality. It sinks down into your unconscious, and it begins to percolate. You know, sometimes it takes months to work through a koan, many sesshins. And you can find that, you know, people will report to me. They'll say, you know, the sesshin was in January, but I woke up last night and I realized I was still, you know, working with my koan. I woke up out of a dream and there was my koan right there at the edge of my consciousness. I wonder if I'm working on it all the time. And I told the person, yes, you are. It's like once you have a koan, it's sort of somewhere in your mind all the time. Like a little piece of sand in an oyster, inside the shell of an oyster that gets turned into a pearl. It's irritating the oyster, and the oyster is secreting the pearl. Your big mind, your unconscious mind, is processing the koan all the time. And it can make you feel a little grouchy sometime, actually. While you're working on a hard koan, sometimes you might feel a little grouchy and not know why. You're working through some inner obstacles. So that's the method of, one of the methods of Zen. There are actually many methods of Zen. But that's the koan, at least, in Zen. And this is a Zen koan, a story. Umon is a great Tang Dynasty Zen master, Chan master, Umon, Yunmen, Cloud Gate. His name is Gate of Cloud. Cloud Gate said, "The world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell?" Now, it's important to know a little background about this story. In China, the monks and nuns wore robes, and the robes had basically were made out of seven pieces, you could say, of cloth. Okay, seven pieces of cloth. In ancient India, Buddhist monks and nuns were supposed to make their robes from a cast-off fabric. So the idea was that people would donate old fabric to monks and nuns, and they would cut the fabric up and sew their robes out of this old, used fabric. And so robes were usually not one fresh piece of cloth. They were usually made from multiple pieces. And when Buddhism went to China, this was symbolized by making a seven-piece robe. Okay? So even if it was the same cloth, they symbolized this ancient tradition with making robes of multiple pieces. So the question is basically addressed primarily to monks and nuns, but it's also addressed to us. Umon is talking to a group of monks and nuns at Taisho, at a certain time of day where he gives teaching, just like this. And he says, it's Saturday morning. You could have done a million different things, but you came to practice Zen. See? You could have done a million different things today, but you came to practice Zen. Why do you do this? See? And now these are monks and nuns, and in ancient India and in China, basically if you wanted to be a monk or a nun, you had to give up everything. You gave up your personal name and took a Dharma name. So you were no longer Kurt or Bill or Susan. You took a Buddhist name, a Dharma ordination name. You were ordained and you took a name. And you shave your head, which symbolizes renouncing worldly life. And you no longer wore nice clothes. You always wore a set of robes every day. My Dharma grandfather was a Japanese Buddhist monk named Miyauchi Kanko. And Miyauchi Kanko I never met, but I'm told he was a person who lived a life of great simplicity. He slept on a tatami mat. He had a very thin futon, and he slept on a tatami mat. And he had a robe for the winter and a robe for the summer. And that was his... And he had a few other items. Something to shave his head. And a begging bowl. And that was it. That was his personal property. So very traditional way to live. Right? So monks and nuns gave up everything to practice the great way of the Buddha. And if you've come to Sesshin, you know, when we go to Sesshin, we live like monks and nuns. We get up at the sound, you know, we have a clapper instead of a bell, but we get up at the sound of the clappers. And the clappers come down the hall, Sandy, the Karmadhana, the coordinator of the Sesshin, goes up and down the halls with clappers and claps them loudly so that people wake up. And then everybody is supposed to be in the Zendo by 5 o'clock. And we recite sutras, and then we have tea, and we have a bathroom break, and then at 6 o'clock we start sitting. And we sit until 7:30, and then we have a bathroom break, and then 8 o'clock is breakfast. And then we finish our breakfast, and we clean up the temple, and then we start sitting again at 10 o'clock. And then at 11 o'clock, we have a dokusan. I mean, we have a teisho. And then at 12 o'clock, we have meditation. And at 12:30, we have lunch. And at 1:30, we have meditation. And at 2:30, we have showers, right? And on and on. Finally, at 10:30 at night, everybody's passing out on their cushions, and I ring the bell, and we go to sleep. Okay? Next day, same thing. Next day, same thing. See? So if you come to Sesshin, highly structured life, highly structured. Pretty much every minute is scheduled. Scheduled. So we do Sesshin a number of times a year. And if you're serious about practicing Zen, sooner or later, you really must do Sesshin, please. And you should try to make at least one a year, just to keep in shape. But this is the life of the monk and the nun. Highly scheduled, highly structured. And Uman is saying to the monks and nuns, you know, at the sound of the bell, you leapt out of bed, you put on your seven-piece robe, and you came here. Why did you do it? Why did you do it? So that's the koan. The life of the monk or the nun is very much like the life in the modern world of most people, you know. In the old days, if you were, say, living on a farm and you were not a monk and a nun, you could kind of get up when you wanted to get up, you know. You just got up when you woke up and you had your work to do, but basically it could be very hard work, but you could do it when you wanted and you could not do it when you wanted, right? And it's true people worked all day, you know, pretty much from dawn till dusk, but, you know, you had a lot of open time on your schedule. Whereas, you know, modern people don't live like that, right? If you have a regular job, you know, you have to get up at a certain time, maybe 6 o'clock, and you have a cup of coffee, and maybe you have breakfast, And then you have your, you know, you take a shower, maybe you iron your clothes, and you have to get to work. And if you live in New Jersey, you know, you have to get out on Route 1 or Route 287 and fight the traffic, and you're looking at your watch, right? You get to work, you're on time, but it was stressful. Maybe you work 8-9 hours a day, right? And then you come home, right? And then you fix dinner. You know, if you have kids, you have to help your kids with their homework. And then it's 10 o'clock, 10:30, you go to bed, and you get up, right? So, you know, our lives are highly structured. And it becomes even more complicated if you want to practice Zen, right? Because somehow, in all of that madness, you have to find a place to slot in some meditation practice. So the easiest way to do that, and the best way to do that, is to get up a little earlier, you know? So instead of getting up maybe at 6, if you get up at 5, you can do your meditation first thing in the morning. It's a wonderful, wonderful way to start the day. Having done it for 40 years, I highly recommend it. And if you don't do it, you'll notice a difference. You won't feel as sharp and as calm. So, slotting Zen into all this other stuff is very difficult. It's already packed, right? And, it's probably the case that this morning, you know, you thought about coming to Zen and you thought, wow, you know, I've had such a stressful, busy week. Maybe I'll just sleep in. But, you know, some people, the people not here today did that. But the people who are here didn't do that. You know, even though you had a stressful week, a difficult week, you came to practice. And the question is, why? Why? Now, you know, I think that there are some things we do that affect us in a certain way. In a certain way that's not so good, I should say, you know. So, I used to run a restaurant. And believe it or not, when I got out of college, I managed a restaurant. And it was a dawn till dusk sort of job. And it was something I really didn't particularly have a passion for. At that time, I didn't know much about cooking. And it was a job, right? I got out of college. It was a high-paying job at that time. This was 1975, and I was making $200 a week. So I felt like a millionaire. The job was like 7 in the morning until 9:30 at night, 6 days a week. And it was very, very stressful, right? Very stressful for me. So when I would get to work in the morning, you know, the first thing I had to do was make sure all my breakfast cooks were there. And if a breakfast cook wasn't there, I had to put on the apron and make the breakfast. And I had to learn how to make poached eggs, sunny side up, sunny side over, you know. And it would be stressful because, you know, you start the eggs, and then if you flip it over wrong, you break the yolk. The customer does not want a broken yolk. You've got to do it again. You know, this kind of thing. If you don't pay attention, you burn the potatoes. You have to throw all the potatoes out. You have to start again. If you don't get the order, the waitresses get mad at you. You know, the waitresses come in. There was a little wheel, and they hang the orders. They'd say, I'm hanging. You know, if it was lunch, it would be, I'm hanging a chicken cacciatore, something salad, blah, blah, blah. You know, if my lunch crew didn't come in, I had to do it. And, you know, if you have 50 people in outside, you know, you're getting everything into the oven, you're pulling it out of the oven. The waitress comes in and she says, okay, I have a sirloin steak and a chicken cacciatore, and you reach in the oven for the chicken cacciatore, but crap, you didn't put it in the oven. So now if the customer waits too long, it blows her tip. She doesn't get the tip. She's mad at you, right? Okay. And this would go on all day long. And then when I wasn't, if I wasn't working in the kitchen, I was in the back room I had to go through the refrigerators every day. I had to make estimates about what to order. I had to meet with salespeople. You know, when dinner came, I actually had a jacket. I would put on my jacket and my tie. You know, and customers were always unhappy. You know, I mean, the food was very good, but there's always somebody unhappy. And, you know, one of the waiters would come into my office and say, "There's an unhappy customer." I'd go out and say, "Sir, you know, how can I help you?" And you go, "This, you know, this was terrible." And but he's eaten everything, right? You know, but you ate it all. You don't say that, though. You don't go, "Well, you ate it. It must have been all right." You know, you say, "Well, I'm very sorry that you did not enjoy the meal. You know, what? How can we improve? You know, and can I get? You know, you have the person bring a free wine for the group, and you say, you know, next time it's on us. You know, we will do better. You know, and then you know." You have to make sure everything gets closed down. And if there isn't, if the dishwasher didn't show up, you have to wash the dishes, right? You know, so you take off your suit and tie, and you roll up your sleeves, and you wash the dishes. And so you know, that was very, very stressful. Very stressful. But, and after a year of doing that, I realized I don't want to be a restaurant manager for the rest of my life. And I went back to graduate school. Later, I met a friend of mine in graduate school who actually is a famous sommelier. He and I were both in graduate school together, but he wasn't interested in graduate school. He was interested in wines. And he used to go down to all the wine stores in Pike Place Market and just study wine. And he became a world-famous sommelier, a wine server at a restaurant. And there's a sommelier competition in Paris, and my friend Larry Stone actually won. He the chefs make a meal, and then the wine steward is supposed to pick the wine that goes with the meal. And he picked, he did something so offbeat and unexpected. You know, people were expecting a white wine, and he picked a Hungarian green wine. And it was like hitting a home run with the bases loaded. The judges, one judge said, "Sagzist, you can do that?" Right? And he got the gold medal or whatever of the sommelier of the year. Right? First American, or second American, I think, ever to get this. You know, he would work in restaurants from, you know, dawn till dusk. Now, you know, when I would talk to Larry, I said, "Larry, isn't it stressful?" And he said, "Stressful? Well, I guess so." See the difference? See the difference? You know, for me, working in that restaurant was not something I wanted to do. And I was constantly closed up and in a defensive position. It was like, "Oh no, what next?" Right? "Don't tell me I have to make breakfast. I always screw up the eggs." You know, "Oh no, not another unhappy customer." Right? So you have to go out and put up with this unhappy customer. And then, you know, then the chef is worried, and he said, no, he was a crackpot, it was delicious, you know, delicious, you know. So, you know, everything I did all day long made me feel defensive. And so at the end of the day, I was totally wiped out. You know, everything I did was like something I didn't want to do or something I was afraid of doing. And so I'm like in a defensive position all day long. And you can't really, you make mistakes when you're like that, right? You know, if you're worried about making mistakes, you make more mistakes. And then if you make mistakes, you feel less confident about yourself, right? You know, when things would go wrong, because I didn't trust myself, you know, it made me very worried, very agitated. And I'd go home at night and I'd just be very, very, I burned out. You know, after doing this for about 8 months, I really became burned out. But, you know, my friend Larry has been a sommelier for like 40 years or 30 some years. And he loves the business. He's been, he's worked with some, in fact, for a while he was running the vineyards for Francis Ford Coppola, the director. And now he has his own vineyards in Oregon, and he's launching his own wine. You know, for him, he loved working in a restaurant. You know, when you walk, if you work in a restaurant, you know, around 7 at night, the place is empty. All the tables are ready. Everything's, the food is ready. Everybody's ready. Nothing happens. Suddenly, there's 100 people in the room. And it's like a bomb goes off, right? Everybody's... Now, look, if you don't like that, it's hell. But if you're Larry Stone, it's heaven. It's like, ah, this is life. This is life, see? So the difference was, you know, I did not want to be there. And I was threatened by everything that was happening, or destabilized by everything that was happening. But for Larry, this was the great theater of his life. He was born to do, he felt, I am born to do this, right? I'm born to be a sommelier. You know, the food, would, you know, he'd be working with the cooks, he'd be out milling about with the customers. You know, when he would go and eat, what are you having for dinner tonight? Oh, I have the perfect wine. How about this? You know, and sometimes he'd have cranky customers. You know, he saw it as part of his mission to teach people about wine. He was like a missionary for wine, right? And people loved him, you know. So that's a difference between being open to what's happening and being closed to what's happening. You know, now, you know, later in my life, after that was done, I went to graduate school. I got out of that place, and I had opportunity to do some cooking for the Zen group, for our Zen community in Seattle. A member would be appointed as a cook for 6 months. So you had to do all the cooking at one of the retreat at two retreats a year, basically. That was your job. It was part of your service to the community. And I had been a cook, and I had run a restaurant, and so they asked me to be the cook for the Zen community. It's called a tenzo, but in Japanese it's called tenzo, the cook or the kitchen person. So anyway, I certainly did not want to be back in a kitchen. And I thought it was wasting my time. I wanted to be out on the cushion doing my meditation and trying to answer my koan. Instead, basically, I was stuck in a kitchen for 6 months, you could say. But, you know, I began to cook for Sesshin, and it was a totally different experience. For some reason, I really got into it. And when people would come to eat, I would look through the door. I'd sort of open the door and look at them eat, and I could see the pleasure they were taking from the really excellent food. I made really excellent food at this sesshin. And even the Roshi, the teacher, came in. He said, you know, man, you can cook, you know. And I felt so good. I felt so proud. And it wasn't just that he was complimenting me. I felt I could look, I would get nervous, and I'd look outside and see the faces. You know, they like it. So I was giving people something, giving them, you know, meditating 8 hours a day, their legs hurt, they come in to eat, and their faces would brighten up. And that made me feel so good. So it really changed the way I was approaching this issue of cooking, you know. If only I could have discovered that back in 1975, I might still be running restaurants. I don't know, but you know, when I was doing the retreat, cooking for the retreats, it was a totally different experience. You know, we would have 25 people. I had to get had to order the food. I had to prepare the food, and I had one assistant for each meal. So I was running around like crazy, chopping, you know, blending, making sure things didn't burn, but different experience, because I brought to it something different spirit, right? There's some kind of a change in me that I think had to do with doing meditation. So, you know, one way to look at life is, you know, this is a danger, a threat, I'm going to make a mistake, I'm going to be humiliated. This is one way to go about things, right? But there's this other way to approach the things you have to do, which is, you know, like, I'm giving something to others. And this makes all the difference. You know, this makes all the difference. Suddenly you feel like a rich man giving money to everybody who needs money. You know, you're going through your day and you're assisting people all day long. You know, nothing is more wonderful than to prepare good food for people. You know, food is the essence. You know, if without food, we're done for. You know, if you make something delicious for people, you bring them joy and happiness. You know, you're giving them a wonderful gift. And if you're doing it at a retreat, you're helping people wake up. You know, so what could be better than that? So it's the different mentality. You know, when we're stuck in a self-centered mindset, it's very difficult to have that generosity, you know, to put the giving first. But when we, you know, if you do enough meditation, you know how not to get trapped in that self-centered mindset. And then, you know, as you go through the day, it's a very different experience when you're not worried and frightened and defensive. Yeah? You know, so my personal feeling is, it's not so much about how many things we have to do in a day as how we do them, right? How we do them. And, you know, you can approach you can approach the things you have to do with very different kinds of mentalities, you know. So, you know, I was talking about this last time, but, you know, I have to write articles. You know, I write articles and I send them out to editors. And some, you know, they do in the academic world, you will write an article in your field and you'll send it to an editor, and the editor will send it to some colleagues of yours who might or might not know who you are but work in your area. And they make an anonymous assessment of your work. And you get it back anonymously, see? So I'll write something, and I'll send it off to an editor, and the editor will send it to two colleagues, and they'll read it. And, you know, every once in a while, usually, you'll get an anonymous review from somebody that's pretty good. You know, somebody will say, well, you know, I'm not in sympathy with the argument, but it's well made, and the evidence is very good. I see some flaws here, here, and here. Somebody might write back and say, I loved it. But every once in a while, you know, you'll get something written by somebody who's very cranky and mean, right? And I've gotten my share of those, you know, actually. You know, the guy's an idiot. You know, he's an idiot. What a ridiculous argument, you know, blah, 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 you know. I mean, if you write anything, you're going to get pushback if you say anything interesting or new, right? So it's probably the case that in about maybe 30% of the things I've written and sent out, I've gotten sometimes rude, but sometimes just negative comments, right? And sometimes the editor is allowed me to revise, and sometimes the editor has disregarded the negative comments. Fortunately, more often than not, that's what's happened. But, you know, if you sit down to write, you know, and you're trying to say something brilliant, or you're trying to answer your critics, that kind of thing, you know, it's paralyzing. You know, it just becomes paralyzing. If you sit down to write and you say, I don't care what the critics are going to say, I don't care whether this is brilliant or ordinary, I'm just going to trust the process, see? It can become incredibly enjoyable, right? Just incredibly enjoyable. For a while in my own life, I went through a kind of a dry spell where I didn't do much writing. And it was after I had received a very negative response in print. I had written something, and then one of my friends, I thought she was my friend, wrote something in a journal that was very negative. So it was kind of traumatic for me, you know. I wrote something, an article that was controversial, but it wasn't. I wasn't rude to anybody. And then later in the same journal, like a year later, I saw the name of my friend, and I opened the journal, and I thought, oh, this is my friend. You know, I wonder what she's written. And it was an attack on me. Really. Or I interpreted it as an attack. It looked like an attack. If somebody shoots a gun at you, it's probably an attack. So it was a pretty scathing review. And in fact, later she actually apologized to me, not in public, but privately. But it did traumatize me. For a while, I didn't write much, you know. And it took me a while to get over that betrayal of trust, right? But, you know, if you worry about people criticizing, you'll never write a word. You just have to trust the process, you know? And I began to do a lot more writing when I stopped worrying about how people would judge my work, right? And it became much more of a process of discovery for me, just being open to the process. You know. You can live, I think, a highly quote unquote structured. You know, a few years ago. Quite a few years ago, actually. I read a wonderful book by a man named Holmes Welch, who was studying. He was an anthropologist. He's deceased now. But after the Cultural Revolution in China, many monks and nuns fled China and went to Hong Kong and to Taiwan. And Holmes Welch was an anthropologist studying Zen temples in China. And he interviewed hundreds of these monks and nuns. And these were monks and nuns who had spent their whole lives in Zen temples doing sesshin. And he said to the monks and nuns, you know, he interviewed them, and again and again, he gives transcripts of of their conversations. And when the monks and nuns would talk about meditation, they didn't call it meditation, they call it work. They said, we did the work. They used the Chinese word for work for meditation. And Holmes Welch said to one of the monks, or a group of older monks, he said, you guys were in a monastery, you know, for 60 years. You meditated for 60 years. You did sesshin for 60 years, you know. What was it like? And one of the monks said, we couldn't wait to get up in the morning and get to the cushion. We couldn't wait to get to the cushion. You know, you think, what was it on the cushion? Right? That you know, after 60, but I have to tell you, I've been doing this for 40 years and I can't wait to get to the cushion. I mean it. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you know, you begin to encounter like a bigger consciousness, bigger life. It's so liberating. You know, and these monks, they had encountered that like bigger mind. Open, it's like the doors open up and there's this bigger, it's just like all the doors in yourself, all the doors in the world open up. It's just heaven. You feel connected to the universe, basically, and that's what these monks were talking about. You know, they had been doing zazen so long they were called old papayas. Do you know, if you know what a papaya, a pie gets ripe, you know, after a while, they were like old papayas. They had been saturated in the Buddha mind for 60 years. So, monks and nuns have highly structured life, and if you don't if you're not doing what you like, that's a problem. Or if you can't find a way to like what you do, that's a problem. But I don't necessarily think having a highly structured life is a problem if it's opening up your world. If you're opening up your world, right? I was just reading about this Japanese artist. I can't recall her name right now, but she's very famous in Japan. And I have never liked her art. Whenever I've seen her art, it hurts my eyes. I dislike it so much. She likes to cover everything with polka dots. Maybe you've seen her art. But basically, if she does a gallery installation, there's like 1,000, these polka dots, these pink and red polka dots all over everything, the walls, the floors, the ceiling. Sometimes she'll do stuff outside. She'll go into a park where there's these trees, and she'll cover everything with paper polka dots. I have always hated it, I have to say. But, you know, I read an interview with her, and it blew my mind. I have a whole different view of polka dots. Because she said, you know, when I was a little girl, she said, I had an experience looking at a piece of polka dot fabric. She said, I felt, I swear to you this is true. I'll put it on the website, on our Facebook page, on our group, meditation group Facebook page this afternoon. She said, when I was a little girl, I was looking at a piece of cloth with polka dots. And she said, I felt myself dissolve completely, and I felt connected to the universe. And she said, whenever I do this with polka dots, I get the same experience. So that is right out of Zen, right? It's like, wow, okay, I like polka dots. So sign me up. I never understood. I never had that experience, but she did. You know, when she looks at polka dots, she feels herself dissolving and she feels connected to a bigger world. So you know, if you want to do meditation and you have a busy day, you may have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Or at the end of a day, it's hard to come here. You know, so I'm tired too, you know, at the end of a day. But it's not so much having lots of things to do in a day. You know, maybe you like to go jogging, you know. That takes time, but at the end of the jog, you feel more alive, right? So, you know, you could say, well, I don't like to have a crowded schedule. I like to have more free time, but, you know, free time doesn't necessarily make you feel more alive. Sometimes free time is just drifting by. You know, so getting up early isn't so bad if you have the chance to connect with the polka dots, right, with the universe. And having a structured life, those monks and nuns had a structured life, but they felt so free, because it's not the structure or absence of structure that makes you free, it's connecting to the world. See, it's connecting. It's dropping out of the small self and connecting with the larger world. Umon said, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the morning bell? Well, now we know. Umon's comment. In studying Zen, you should not be swayed by sounds and forms. Even though you attain insight when hearing a voice or seeing a form, this is the ordinary way of things. Don't you know that real Zen students command sound, control form, are clear-sighted at every event and free on all occasions? This is a way of saying it's not structure that it's... You can be in a highly structured environment but still feel very free. You can be in an unstructured environment and not feel free at all. Granted you are free, tell me, does the sound come to the ear or does the ear go to the sound? If both sound and silence die away at such a juncture, how could you talk of Zen? While listening with your ear, you cannot tell. When hearing with your eye, you are truly intimate. So when you're experiencing that connection with the universe, you're hearing with your eye and seeing with your ear. Mumon's verse. Without realization, things make one family. I'm sorry, with realization, things make one family. Without realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. Without realization, things make one family. With realization, things are separated in a thousand ways. In other words, you might be working in a kitchen, and you might think, I don't want to be in the kitchen, right? I wasn't made for the kitchen. Maybe that's true, but you know, it's how you're approaching working in the kitchen. It's how you approach, everything can help you to wake up. Everything, the Buddhist teaching is that everything is helping you to wake up. Everything is, so when you find yourself, when you're doing something that you don't like, if you can change it, that's good. But if you can't change it, there's a secret. You can change the way you do it, and it can become another opportunity to wake up in this life.